Hi there.
Hi
Greetings.
there.
Hello.
Greetings.
Hello, everyone.
You're in Christmas red, John?
Yes. Merry Christmas, everybody. Ho, ho, ho.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Welcome back.
We've missed you, Michael.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was moving my feet slowly with the pandemic. California had a major shutdown, and I had to adjust to what that meant.
Oh, yeah, we're back in lockdown. And it's ours cold.
Is it cold? It's cold in California?
Well, yes. It's cold. Yeah, it's cold here today.
Oh, okay.
For California, it's cold. Let's be clear.
Yeah. We had snow. We had a flurry of snow last week.
We have about a foot of snow right now. So
wow. I don't know how you do.
The temperature has gone to like minus 10 degrees Celsius. So it's
Are you kidding? It's just like midwinter already. That's amazing.
Wow. So I thought we'd start with a kind of circumambulation, you know, since I started out this course saying, you know, we're going to kind of circumambulate around, you know, a bunch of topics. And as kind of a way of taking stock of where we've been, I put them all on a circle. So let me just pull up my screen share here real quick. So here's where we've been. And this is just kind of the highlights, actually. We started over here at paradigm shift. And just, where did my cursor go? I don't see my cursor. Anyhow, we started at paradigm shift and wandered clockwise as I've created this. Oops. Talking about the way language shifts naturally, either or is a subset of both and we wandered back to both and in various forms later on. Oh, Michaela, great, welcome. We talked about consciousness and self-consciousness and, you know, a bunch about Gebser and, you know, mutations of consciousness. We talked about multiple layers of meaning and mythologic thinking and images, and we came back to that a few times over the course. We talked about what is a subject, you know, who is the I, and objects and boundaries and the porosity of boundaries, the fractal nature of boundaries. We talked about being one with and what does that entail and how we've experienced it. Ego boundaries and the loss thereof and how that happens when we become one with. We talked about content words versus function words and how the function words are sort of like the structure, you know, like the trunk and branches of the tree, and the content words are you know, more like leaves that change over time. So back to, you know, the way language shifts naturally. Speaking from wholeness and not just about it, and what does that entail? What might that look like? And how language structures what can be said or what must be said, and the different ways that languages mark the things that you must say, and some of the differences between other languages and English. Metaphors and networks of concepts. We talked a bunch about that. Getting into the work of Lakoff and Johnson. We talked about complexes in one of the workshops and how they have us. We talked about the Möbius strip and Klein bottle, and getting back, that sort of helped, you know, we circumambulated back to the both and conversations about both and in there. We talked about diamond consciousness, which took us back to thinking about boundaries. We talked about, you know, things versus processes, and that took us back to thinking about what are subjects and what are objects. Visual manifestation of paradox, that took us back to Möbius strips and Klein bottles and Necker cubes. Archetypes, that took us back to thinking in images, mythologic thinking. Agency, what is agency? That took us back to what is a subject. Subject and object, telling a new story, and all the other ways that language structures our lives. It's the foundation for, you know, most of the institutions, from government to education to marriage to, even the financial industry is, you know, grounded in language, not just math. We did some managing of polarities in one of the workshops, which was a circumambulation with both and either or, and paradoxes. We talked about invisible architectures and some visible ones, and how language is one of the invisible architectures. Similarly, we talked about space and what is space, and we got into notions of the unification of space and subject and object in Steve Rosen's writing, which he calls spatio-subobjectivity, where space isn't just the usual container for subjects and objects, but is also but instead is interwoven with them. You know, the boundaries are porous. We looked at systems thinking and read some Donella Meadows and, you know, what are some of the leverage points in a system that one could take advantage of to alter the system. Some leverage points can only alter little things, you know, like rearranging chairs on the Titanic, and some leverage points can alter things in a big way, you know, like changing the course of the boat you know, several miles out before it came so close to the iceberg. We're still talking about the Titanic here. Logic, we read a little bit of Graham Priest and alternative logics, and this took us back on a circumambulation to, you know, either or and both and, in terms of true or false, or true and false, or neither true nor false. And how might logic itself need to change if we start bringing in some of these mobile and Kleinian notions to language. Oops. We did the little movie on conlanging and looked at people who are inventing languages. We talked about listening and the importance of listening and how that's as much a structure, you know, an invisible architecture for language. Talked again about Gibbs's structures of consciousness. We talked about orality and the, you know, not just the visual part of language, but also, you know, the sound, the hearing part of language. I should probably have put that one next to listening. We talked about the ecosystem of linguistic structures, you know, that language is, you know, also part of the culture, which determines what the category structures are and, you know, gives us context. And then, shoot, this is a very sensitive touchpad. Sorry about that. And also the subsystems, you know, the concepts and sign vehicles and you know, semantics and syntax and all of those parts of language as well that we have to mind for thinking about evolving. Paradox, again, that is kind of a theme throughout. Objects that are both physical and non-physical. I think that was talked about in the discussion threads. And now we're getting into the ability of words to create worlds. We've been, you know, talking about questioning assumptions throughout this whole course, but it came up, you know, very front and center in the reading for this week. And of course, you know, the future you want to live into, if we're consciously working with language, we have to work with it in terms of, well, what is the future we want to bring about, if possible? You know, I'm not saying that, you know, of course it's gonna work, but it exists as a possibility. And then also for today, we've got the topic of finite and infinite games, which pulls us back to the either or and both and. As finite games are mainly grounded in either or, and infinite games are grounded more in both and, although, you know, that's not a hard and fast dichotomy. So this is sort of a recap of what did we speak. And of course, you know, Wittgenstein famously said, you know, that of which you cannot speak, you must remain silent. And so there's also this, you know, of what can't we speak? And the finite, the second part, the second half of the finite and infinite games, you know, he starts out by saying, you know, nature can't speak. So, so those are just the, you know, the poles of speaking and silence that we're operating within. So we've come, let me stop sharing here. We've come a long way. We really covered a lot of territory, a lot of ground. And I really appreciate all of you for sticking with it this whole time. This has been really a great experience for me. I've got a couple of questions I want to ask, but before I ask mine, I'll open the floor up. Is there anything else you want to add or subtract from that little overview of the last 3 months or so? Yeah, Michael.
I just want to say, I'm not sure if I've totally grokked the evolution of language, but what I have grokked by being open to what you're trying to put forth is, I'll put it in this sense, that language being a tool, and there's ways to relate and improve the tool, like take a simple screwdriver. Now they can make it so that you ratchet it, you improve that very tool, or you attach it to something. That is the kind of evolution, or it's a relational evolution. I don't know about language itself evolving, but maybe it dovetails together, because I, and participating, I have a much more just extremely intensely open to the complexity and the value of language just in my everyday life when I talk to somebody and how I listen. And I think the listening part, when you brought that in, that resonates with me a lot, because I feel listening has been forsaken in the name of being able to speak, and they should go together. So I just want to bring that forward.
Thank you. Yeah, and listening and speaking are one of those mutual, interdependent, I wouldn't say they're opposites, but they're mutually dependent.
Well, and I think it ties in, like you said, you're either listening or you're speaking, but you're both and too. There's an interlistening that, I can't remember her name, a book that I read that was along of trying to add a kind of new way of saying interlistening. The way I'm listening to myself as I'm speaking to you, and vice versa, that listening may be in the background, but it's not out of the dynamic of communication.
Well, that's an interesting term. I've not heard that before.
Yeah. I'll try to find the name of it. It was about attunement and ethics in listening and speaking. I'll email you the author's name.
Oh, thanks.
I have something that's kind of not thought out very clearly, but that's okay. There's a circle, right? Can you see? I don't know if you guys, there's a circle,
uh-huh.
And then there's an ellipse, right?
Yeah.
And if it gets more elliptical, it's eventually going to turn into a line. Okay. So they've done these experiments with a dog. If you show a dog a circle and you've trained the dog to perform a certain task, when it sees that circle, it will very happily wag its tail and go off and do that task and come back for your approval. But if you start shrinking, or if you start creating, going from a circle to an ellipse, the dog will get confused, because it won't, that's an ambiguous gesture. And it won't know what to do. if you continue to create an elliptical shape and moving it more towards a line, the dog will, it'll go, and if you continue to give it an ambiguous message, make the ellipse even more of an elliptical, it will go, and it will turn in a circle at the same time. And then if you proceed to go in that direction, making it a more ambiguous signal, the dog will bite you. Okay. So just notice how the dog embodies the paradoxical messages that it's receiving. And notice that you can lose rapport with the animal, and it will attack you if you continue to give a paradoxical message to it. I would make the claim that dogs are smarter than we are. We go ahead and try to make sense of these paradoxical messages that we're receiving in an environment that is not very supportive of our wholeness, but tends much more to try to fragment, conquer, divide, separate. And you know, maybe you'll get a few crumbs at the end of the day after you've complied with trying to make sense of all these paradoxical messages. Or I think you can do something that Jane Kars is inviting us to do, which is to turn that finite game constructed by finite players who are into win-lose, and they want you to lose, into something that's an infinite game. And I think I'm so glad you recommended that reading, because I read it in my 20s and I could make very little sense of it. But now it makes marvelous good sense, because I realized how often I was seduced by others to move out of an infinite game into a finite game, and vice versa. So I don't think we're either one or the other. We're finite players or infinite players. I believe we find ourselves constantly in, there are many different contexts where we have to make choices, we make decisions. And I think the more adept and skillful we are at noticing the paradoxical language of others, if it's a paradox, it isn't creating a infinite game, but a paradox that's creating a finite game in which they will win and you will lose. So I think we're in this, I think as we move from centers, I have a center, you have a center, I assume, and then there's peripheries. And it gets very complex when we're speaking from, we were talking about speaking about the integral rather than from the integral, and how paradoxical that can become. I think it's, and what I'm learning, what I've learned from this course so far, and I hope I will continue to learn after this course is over, is that I can speak from this center here to a concept of the whole, which is moving around quite a bit. And I move from a center to a periphery within the self. So there are more than one, I would say, there are many parts to this wholeness, which is the self. But it is a conceptual wholeness. It's not something that I can see, hear, smell, taste, touch. It's a concept. So it has a semantic quality, which is extremely fuzzy. The boundaries of the self and with operating with other selves is extremely fuzzy and very porous. And I think we've brought this feature out in our discourse events here and also online. I think in many of our threads, we've been playing at these kinds of paradoxical communications that we can give and receive from one another. And whether or not those are ecological and healthy has a lot to do with what we want to have happen, which is my mantra. Well, what do you want to have happen? I'm not claiming that just because you know what you want to have happen, you're going to get that. But I think if you know what you want to have happen, and if you've invited another person, well, what would you like to have happen? You might start to play what I think Kars is calling an infinite game together, rather than falling into polarized debates where you already know what the answer to this is. So you just have to win this debate and you have to beat out the other person. into something I believe that comes more dialogical and triological and much more interesting and fun to play, that's for sure. But there are no guarantees either. And I'm not saying all finite games are bad. I think they're, you better know how to change a diaper, you know, and, you know, being able to make a cup of tea. And you do have to tie your own shoelaces, or someone else is going to have to do that for you. So I think those finite capacities, which we all know, there are millions of finite games you've learned how to play, from riding a bicycle to cooking dinner to being able to log on to your computer. So I don't think we should have to do all that consciously. I think those finite games serve a very good purpose because they allow us to function adequately without having to do anything consciously. We just plug in. But I think in those times that come in everybody's life where you're up against it, there's a paradoxical communication or a conflict or an impasse. And I think we're dealing with a lot of them right now, collectively. Then there comes a time, well, am I going to be a winner? And which requires that you be a loser? Or can I do something else? So that's what I'm learning from this course. And I'm learning from each of you and the language that you use, which for me is like, I get so thrilled when I hear someone using paradoxical language, because it goes, oh yes, now I get a practice. There's a bind, I feel a bind, I feel a double bind, I feel a triple bind. And I think that's the kind of world we're living in. We don't have just binds we're dealing with, we're dealing with triple binds. It's like those two guys who wanted, those gunslingers at high noon, there they are. One of them has to shoot the other one. But deep down say neither of them wants to shoot the other one, nor do they want to get shot. So what do? One of them pulls his gun out and he drops it on the ground. And that's a signal that they can release themselves from this win-lose dynamic, and they can go into the saloon and have a drink. But what if there's a guy on the roof who has a rifle and he says the first guy who drops his gun gets shot? That's an excellent example, I believe, of a double bind. So it's a bind that holds this primary bind together. So that's a double bind, maybe even a triple bind, because there may be someone who's aiming a rifle at that guy on that rooftop who has that rifle aimed at those two gunslingers in the street. So there you have a triple bind. And I think this is the kind of world we're living in. So I'm not trying to oversimplify this. Because it's very, very complex. But if we can be aware of these dynamics, hopefully we can be released someday from this Republican-Democrat charade. Maybe not, but I think if enough of us were training our attention to these dynamics, I believe we could be unleashing certain super, what I would call, what Aurobindo, I think, was referencing quite a bit, these superpowers that are potentially within human beings. And on occasion, we've seen this. There have been many people who have been able to manifest these superpowers. So anyway, thank you so much for giving me the chance to rehearse this in public space, because these things are not easy to talk about. So thank you.
So I'm curious where you put democracy in the finite and infinite game picture.
So I have something to say about that, because I've been thinking about this, because so I don't know if you are people who read Scientific American, but a number of years ago there was an article by Douglas Hofstadter, who is the person who wrote Gödel-ish or Bach.
Yeah.
And Hofstadter wrote a piece about a game that he called which was actually from another philosopher, mathematician, I think, called gnomic. And gnomic is a game about a game that simulates democracy in a way. It's designed to do that. And when I saw this article, I was really excited about it. So I roped in a bunch of my friends who kind of came along for it, because they liked me, but not because they were really interested in the game. And so I explained, you know, there's a rather complicated set of rules. I went through the text. I explained it all. We set up the processes. You know, there had to be rules that we had to decide between ourselves about how decisions were made. So we set up all these rules, decisions. And then after setting up all these rules and decisions, within about an hour from there, the group had essentially decided to abandon the game formally through the rules of the game. So there was nothing I could do about it because we'd already agreed to all the rules. They followed them, but their process was to throw out the rules and the game ended, you know, so we were from this. So it was a life lesson for me because, and one that often comes back, but it was just I'm not sure what it means about democracy, but I think we like rules, but we don't like rules. So there's a kind of paradox there, right? So we will accept rules, but we try to use them to get outside of rules. I mean, that's the whole thing with the legal system. Right. So and democracy may be part of that too. You know, I don't know whether the Trump, you know, that word already had a meaning, right? Trump, it already has a very different meaning, Trump. So there's a language issue, right? So when you Trump somebody, it's not going to mean the same as it used to.
Just briefly. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just going to finish and say that I think that in some ways, Trump plays the game of democracy like my co-players played Gnomic. They're using the rules to get out of the rules. Now, not in a way that we like. I mean, most of us don't like it, although some people do. Yeah, it's a tricky thing. So I'm not quite sure what the end result I'm trying to say about it is, but I do think it's relevant.
I think that's very relevant. And I think that's a great, great question, research question, Lisa. And very briefly, my response to it is George Washington, the first president of the United States, when the term of office was over, he stepped down. Europe was shocked because never in history has a general who got power ever voluntarily let go of that power. So what resonates with me now, George Washington was a very flawed person. He was a slave owner and very wealthy because of that. But that in that moment, he turned a finite game into an infinite one by complying with the terms of office that our, you know, founding fathers and mothers worked very hard to create a structure for that, with the distribution of power, checks and balances, and how you move from being in a position of power to being another citizen once again. This is a huge experiment, and I think this is an ongoing one. And I don't know that we have, I think Godel says, a system that is complete. Godel says, a formal system that is complete and consistent does not exist. So I think this is what we have to deal with, is that if we want to be complete, we can't be consistent. If we want to be consistent, we're not going to be complete. And I think this is that paradox that that I think democracy at its best demands of us. But a lot of people don't want to play that. They just want to win. And I think that's probably what was going on, someone in the dynamic that you were trying to describe, Jeffrey, as people just broke the rules because they didn't want to play the game.
But they didn't break the rules. They used the rules to break the game. So this is a very different thing.
Well, I can be kind of sympathetic to that because I think there's an element of anarchism that's engaged in those who use the rules. If the rules were applied to them and they were not there when the rules were made, do you have a is it required of you that you obey such rules or comply with them?
Well, that's the legal system, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which is different from ethics or morality.
Yeah.
And we have a legal system which favors the few over the many, as we have now. That's very problematic.
So a nice can of worms we opened up there.
I'd like to pick up on the completeness and consistency thing, because that's an interesting introduction. Because in one sense, consistency would be, you know, like the Republicans winning all the time, which is what they want, as opposed to completeness, which is, you know, the finite game of democracy, where there are winners and losers every 2 or 4 years, depending on, you know, which election we're having. The finite game perpetuates the infinite game. Whereas when you turn the finite game, where there's inconsistency, you've got winners, you know, on one side and losers on the other, and it flips back and forth, and you know, there's mix-ups and all that sort of thing. If you try to turn that into a consistent finite game, you get authoritarianism. You get what the Republican Party is trying to do, which is consolidate their power so that they're the winners all the time, period. They don't want to lose. Saturday Night Live actually did a really, you know, good sketch about this this past Saturday. If you want to take a look on YouTube, you know, Trump has gone away from Fox toward Newsmax, which is, you know, like just a, you know, a Trump cheerleading station. And so Saturday Night Live said, you know, they said, well, you know, since Newsmax is doing so well, we've expanded into Sportsmax for the Jets. And basically it was like, you know, the Jets, they're in a world where the Jets only win. So the main commentator comes on and says, you know, the Jets have lost 11 out of the, you know, 12 games they've played. But then these, you know, the two commentators on that were like, no, the Jets have won all the games they've played, you know, and they start rewriting this, you know, reality into this finite game that is consistent and wrong, a total lie. Anyhow, I'm not doing it justice. You can find it on YouTube, but it speaks beautifully to this finite and infinite games concept.
But I have one question for you now. Asked us about democracy. What about capitalism? Can you have a democratic system, a healthy one, within a system that is driven by capital, and who owns it and who does not, and profit motives? That I think is about the double and maybe triple bind that we're in, that I don't think any of us have figured this out yet.
That's a really interesting way to put it, John. Democracy and capitalism are like a double bind. I'll have to think about that some more. That's a interesting question.
Well, it's an open question. I am not proposing that I have an answer to that, but I think we're in the grips of this dilemma about capitalism and democracy and vast inequalities of wealth. And how can a democracy flourish in those conditions? I don't think it can. But I think if the winner takes all is your economic driver, then I think the democracy is going to be extremely fragile, if possible at all. So I think these are what drives a lot of totalitarian regimes, and they don't last long. They can succeed, but they usually create enormous collapse very quickly, as if Hitler and his minions could have lasted 1,000 years. I mean, really, I mean, people would have gotten so bored shitless, you know, and it only lasted like four years, that great war. Anyway, I'm just sharing this out loud. That's why I don't think Trump is so invincible. I think he's not able to deal with the contradictions that he's generating around him, which he gives him a false sense of power, but I don't think that power could last indefinitely. And he only had one term so far, unless he pulls off a coup.
Well, there's a paradox in democracy, which is that a group of democratic citizens can democratically vote themselves out of their own democracy. And this has almost just happened in the United States and has happened elsewhere before. And I think that is like irreconcilable. Like that is a property of freedom that belongs to freedom. If you can't choose not to be free, then you weren't free to begin with. But I think, you know, there's been a long thread on the forum about the future of democracy. That's kind of overlapped a little bit with the discussions on evolving language. But I think it's useful to go back to that other thread because it was Ed posted it. And it was comments on an article called The Silenced Majority by Rana Dasgupta from Harper's Magazine. And really that article, I think the point that it was making, like the key idea was that here's how I would interpret it, is that democracy is an arrangement made amongst people who own or who have control over resources, a set of resources, land, production capacity, whatever it may be. And so that's why the original Athenian democracy and then even the original American democracy was supposed to be an agreement amongst property owners, those who actually had the power. And something happened historically where a whole group of people, which we come to call the working class, gained kind of a stake in that larger system because in Great Britain, in the United States, and other, you know, what we call Western countries, they were required to run the machines. But a struggle between capital and labor kind of worked out what we experience as kind of modern 20th century democracy, where rights are more widely distributed, where power is more widely distributed. But that those same underlying technological trends, the same technological evolution, if you want to call it that, is bringing us to a point where a whole lot of people are not needed by the systems of production, like that more and more of it is automated, robots, AI. And the question is, and what I think the article is pointing to, is the fact that people who do own this stuff, do own the machines and own the servers, and who are the billionaires and the 1%, I think there's a resentment that they own everything, but there's still too much distributed control, that the masses who are not actual, who are not as necessary anymore, still have kind of disproportionate power. And so this kind of struggle to use the rule, the tools of democracy, the systems of democracy to undo democracy, is like it's coming from outside the system. It's coming from outside of the game, kind of like in Jeffrey's example. And I think language is very interesting here, and it's kind of points to some kind of weird cosmic joke, because of course, like Trump, like means to Trump, like in a game, the Trump card is the card that lets you like kind of suspend all the other normal rules. And like, here we are in reality and a Trump card has been played and it's thrown everything into chaos, and we have to reconstruct the game. But the working class is not on the, let's say, on the favored side of history here, I think.
I have a question for you.
Oh, okay. Sure. What I see, I think, through this is that evolving language, I don't know how to do that, but I think, and that's what's gotten a little bit clearer to me here. Like, I struggle enough with English, you know, I struggle enough just with, you know, what I have, what I can already, you know, theoretically should be able to do. But our relationship with language, I think what we could change. Because what I think has evolved in our social sphere is a really, very, very, how to put this, sophisticated kind of language games that are meant to kind of confound and to suppress and to kind of confuse, muddy the waters, just incapacitate us. And the degree to which we can, I think, gain some distance from the effect of toxic language, the effect of manipulative language, and begin to reconstitute a relationship with language and meaning making that allows us to deal with what's happening. There I think is where there's a pathway forward. There's where I think that there's hope, and we have to change the terms of ownership. I think, like, what does it mean to, you know, to live on a planet together and own it, like, as humans? Something about this idea of property itself, which is kind of underlying the game of democracy and a lot of our language games. I think that's what we have to kind of look at and acknowledge, like, where are we actually in power and in control, and where are we dispossessed and just living in somebody else's, you know, fantasy. Go for it.
I want to ask a question, but I also want to shut up so other people can come forward, because I know there are a lot of people who have a lot to say about this, but my question is there a relationship between the working class and essential workers? And I agree about who owns what and the commons. Can we own the air? Can we own the oceans? Is any of that ownable? Or our language? Is that who owns the language? But I think our language is starting to evolve out of corporate elites who own, you know, the robotics, the AI, and who have an agenda. And the working class, that poor lumpen proletariat who has to follow orders. I think we can get really seduced into, like Carr says, you can't be a victim unless you allow yourself to be played that way, unless you agree. So that master-slave dynamic, I believe that the masters desperately need the creativity of the slaves. I think the slaves can do perfectly well without the masters. And I think the masters know this. And I think they want to keep everyone as stupid as they can and as distracted and confused as they can, so that they can continue this win-lose master-slave dynamic. So that's my two cents. But I think you can't speak to power, about power, unless you have power. And I'm saying the power of a, what's her name? Her name is Parks.
Rosa Parks.
She refused to give up her seat. That's what I call power. And I think we seduce ourselves in thinking, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I should just go work on Wall Street and make millions of dollars, just like all the other happy nihilists do. I think that's bullshit. And I don't think there's anything on this planet without power, like the mosquito that keeps you up at night. That's an agent and it has power. And the biome, the bacteria in our gut is extremely powerful and we depend upon it. So that's also part of what do we own? And what do we not own? And because it cannot be owned. And also our language. Can language become a virus? I think William Burroughs thought it could. So I'm just throwing that out there because I think it's so easy for us to get seduced into thinking, oh, we're just powerless. There's nothing we can do. These guys are so big and we're so small. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, I like to bring forward and listening to both Marco and Johnny. One, to Marco, I'm not sure. I know we're doing a lot of automation, but I don't know how long it's going to take before you're going to have some human beings greasing those wheels, maintaining them, fixing them, because they are machines. Maybe eventually they'll have machines working on machines, but not right away, at least. And maybe there are some now. So, you know, in the meantime, to go to Johnny's point and talking about power, I think this is one of the elements, and I'm going to come from my, you know, stock and trade. Unless we understand the power of the language of the body, it talks to us as we interact, just like now, as I'm listening to Marco and everybody. My body is giving me, I'm listening to what to say next, how to say it, how, what to do. That's a language, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not sure it's a language that we've been talking about on this workshop, but it does, the main component to this language, from my point of view, is how do we develop an ability to listen to those times when we're feeling like a victim and choosing not to be a victim? Because we have to do that. It's really easy to feel like a victim and then get trapped in a storyline about, yes, you can be victimized, but Johnny's right. You have to work with not letting that become, you're trapped in that role. And even if I have the power to speak to Donald Trump right now and say, fuck you, motherfucker, I have power to say that, but I'm not going to be stupid when I say it, because more than likely he's got enough power to just put me away in jail forever. So there's a wisdom component that we have to work with in terms of how we use power ourselves and how that can possibly radiate out democratically to more and more people, because that's what we have. We have so many different levels of people being out of touch of even the what democracy really, really, really is about, in my view. Thank you.
I would just reply, Michael. I think it's a matter of population. Like, I think that the people that are like looking at the big picture and, you know, the world system are, I mean, here's a question I would counterpose, like, do you need 8 billion people to keep the machines running? How many do you actually need? I'm just saying from that perspective, that's not my view, of course. But I think that's where it's coming from.
I felt that that's what you were saying, but I'm a maintenance person. I'm saying I'm not giving up my job, damn it.
Yeah, and just the idea of power, I completely agree with that too. I mean, I think that part of the creative challenge, I think, is to maybe like create language viruses that undo some of the ideas that we have about things, like some of the underlying and unspoken ideas, because there's things that are just not even on the table. Right. Mm-hmm. Like the way that during the healthcare debate in the US, single mm-hmm. care was just not even on the table.
Right.
And that was a conscious decision amongst the participants because they wanted, you know, to get a deal done of some kind. So, I mean, it's not just a double or triple bind. I mean, it's like the whole thing is bound because now we have all these dependencies, right? The essential workers are a dependency of the system as a whole. And so they, of course, have to be cared for, right? Like that's going to be favored. That's going to be incentivized, right, in the system. But those who are not, I think just without even necessarily the conscious intent, are going to become like the underclass. They're going to become the disposable ones, you know, the dispensable ones. What did Hillary Clinton call them? The
untouchables.
The untouchables.
Right.
The untouchables. Deplorables, she called them.
Yeah, deplorable.
So, I mean, I think at the core of this consciously evolving language inquiry, we've had this idea of getting beyond the either or and getting beyond the us and them. I think the us and them is the core ones, because people can get through a lot if they believe that they're belong to each other. They believe that they're part of on the same team. Like they could play the game to win. They could play the game to keep playing if they feel like they're included. If they feel like they're not part of the game, they're not part of, if they feel like they're just the losers and the victims, then I think that they will do what they have to do to, you know, to escape the bind that they're in.
Yeah, so. I agree.
Is a hedge fund manager an essential worker?
Marco, I would like you to maybe nuance, because I think part of the problem is the way we have this yearning to be part of a group, but it has its upsides and downsides, as we, you know, understand that, you know, the people that belong to, you know, that are for Trump, they're part of his group because they like what he's saying. And my critique of that group is you're not thinking outside the box, period. You're not having enough independence. Well, they would disagree with me, I know, but you know, this, we have a yearning to be part of a group, but yet there's groups fighting groups. I don't know if I'm saying it right. You know what I'm trying to articulate?
I think you guys touched on it in the Axial Age discussion, because in the Axial Age, as I understand it, a new idea kind of arose, like a new consciousness came forth, which transcended in group identity. Like it was like, you're one with the all, like you have an experience of the one, the divine, the universe, like the whole, that isn't limited. I mean, although it gets turned into specific sect religions and sects and things like that, I think at the core mystical experience isn't, you know, is one with everything, right? So, and everyone. So what would a politics look like? What would language games look like that have that at the core? I think it would be totally different, right? But most people are not really operating from that center of gravity.
Yeah,
they're operating right. More from a tribal or national level identities, where there is us and them, and inside and outside.
Right.
And then, you know, language is used to police those boundaries. To create the stories that hold people together, and then also that distinguish those people from those who are not those people, right? The others. That axial revolution, like in consciousness, it's not totally widespread yet. But I mean, the idea that many have put forward is that it's coming forth. It's being born now, as the structures of like mental, you know, rationality break down, so bring it on. Like that's
in a way we have no choice either. I mean, not in a nihilistic way. We have no choice in the sense things are going to happen, but we do have a choice how we respond to what happens as we're in the middle of it.
I believe so.
I think we do have a choice, and we have to know what we want to have happen. If we want that to happen, we can create conditions for that. But I think we do still require an agent with other agents to make things we want happen collectively. And the second axial age, that's what we were talking about, creating the conditions for a second axial age. The first axial age happened a long time ago, and there are many debates about what it even was, or even if there was an axial age, but there were certainly individuals who obviously demonstrated a different kind of cognition. The Bodhisattva vow, or the, what did Jesus call that? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This was a new note that was being struck in the cognition of individuals, many individuals. And I think these are those kind of, are we moving from a finite game with masters and slaves and winners and losers? Or is there an opportunity for creating conditions for an infinite game? I definitely think the second axial age would be an instance of that. But I don't think it's going to happen because history somehow unfolds in an infinitely progressive game. I don't think so. I think or that is built like a layer cake, as I posted, a wedding cake with the heterosexual couple on top. I think that's, that tower of sugar with the compulsory heterosexual union is a defended cultural artifact, but it isn't universal. And I think that's the problem we have when we talk about universals and wholeness. That can so easily become that I know what your essence is. And because I can tell you what your essence is, I can manipulate you in a certain way. And I think that's a real, real danger. And I think we need to start appreciating that people may indeed have an essence, but it isn't something that I can know about that other person.
Not without relating to them. Actually talking like we're doing right now on this site. This is an example of setting the conditions, John. This very site, this very cafe, to me, are the kind of conditions I go to do exactly what you do. Because by me working with the conditions on this cafe, I am so much better of not getting butthurt by other people's stupidity. So much better.
So you're more resilient, even though there's stupid people around you. They're
acting stupid, and I remember that doesn't mean I get to label that's all they are.
Right.
I mean, I can be held accountable in the same way. Don't get me wrong. I've acted stupid in the moment too, but fortunately, I have had models to show me. Okay, Mike, you're being stupid. I still love you, but you need to leave. You're being stupid. you need to leave.
Thank you.
I kind of wanted to come back. There was the issue. So I think Marco may have raised it, or John, I can't remember, but the issue of the sort of murkiness of the information landscape right now, the fragmented, the bubble nature, maybe Lisa, you were talking about it. But I have this kind of gut feeling that this is not... although there may be an evil cabal operating, I don't think this is the result of an evil cabal. I think it's intrinsic in the nature of information and how information circulates. It's essentially an outgrowth of the internet. As soon as the possibility to share information in such a widespread open way came about, the sort of fragmentation of information came along with that. So
So I'm not quite sure what I'm saying. I seem to be a more kind of open and ended game myself today rather than a closed game. But so I don't know where my own arguments are going, but there are issues that I'm struggling with understanding. But I do think that how we deal with the information fragmentation problem is not going to be solved by focusing on a group of people who we assume are doing something dastardly towards the rest of us. I think it has to be done as a systems understanding of what's going on in terms of the way information circulates in our world. And I don't know that we actually have that systems understanding yet. I think it's still part of our struggle to identify what those issues are and how they need to be put into play in order to manage this.
Well, and there's always in play somebody that going off of what, there's always somebody in play that following your line, Jeffrey, there's always somebody in play that uses whatever's the natural, you know, happening, like you're saying, that will misuse or use it in nefarious ways. And that complicates things, doesn't it? When
it
you know
complicates
that,
it, but it's not the main driver.
No. And I just want to know if that's fair to say it complicates it.
Yeah, I think it's fair. And it comes back to the language issue. So again, I mean, I do love the circle that you introduced this discussion today with, Lisa, because it underlines the complexity of the issues that we've been looking at. I mean, you could spend a lifetime looking at any one of those issues, and here we are trying to sort of shovel our way through this stuff together. but one of the things I like about your approach, Lisa, is focusing on all of the different levels in which language comes into play. It's not just, as you say, the micro level, but also the, you know, I think in your text on the last chapter or the last chapter but one in the Consciously Evolving Language book, you talked about how your own understanding has evolved as you realized that you couldn't focus on just one level, but you had to focus on all the different levels. And that seems to be the problem that we're dealing with today in terms of what we're trying to do as a society is, you can't do it by focusing on one level. You have to focus on all the different levels. And obviously we can't do that individually. We have to do that collectively. So, and the language issue is tied in with it, like it or not. There's no way out of the language problem by ignoring it. It's very much a part and parcel of the whole. Anyway, I'm going to stop there because I'm rambling. But,
I didn't know where we want to go with this, but I think is a hedge fund manager an essential worker? Is the cashier at Trader Joe's an essential worker? I think the whole idea of essential worker is something new in our language. And is the elites who own the technology and who license it and who are empowered by our participation in that technology, are they necessary? Are they essential workers? Are they workers at all? I mean, the internet was, I understand, produced by the US military. And then it became something else as we participated with it. But that original participation of the US military hasn't gone away. So I think these are the big challenges, and I really appreciate what you're bringing forward, Jeffrey, about the technology and the fragmentation that all of us are experiencing now and our social worlds, how they're collapsing very rapidly. Right here in New York, the streets are full of trash. The restaurants are closing again. It's going to be a long, hard winter. I'm very thankful that there are cashiers and stock clerks who can keep the food distributed in this very stressed out environment. And I think that we have to recognize who decides who the essential workers are, what the working class is that's no longer necessary. And those who are creating a technology that's out of control already for you know, short-term profits for themselves. How essential are they? And that's where I think, you know, a new language can start to get played out, and hopefully not repolarize debates, but we can turn these debates into something that's more like a contrast than a conflict. And because I think the elites have had a purpose, a very important purpose, until now. Because if the working class is now irrelevant because of the technology, so are they. Who needs to manage the workers? The elites? That's like a dead end job. I mean, and I think that's how the technology, which is fragmenting us now, could possibly be a part of our liberation. If we want that to happen, and if we want it to have happen, we're going to have to learn how to talk pretty someday. We need people who can make really pretty speeches. Unfortunately, Obama was such a person, but he, I think, had an opportunity to become a infinite player, but he was seduced into becoming a finite player. And that's why I think Donald Trump is a direct result of that set of circumstances and the decisions that he made. I think we could look at Edward Snowden's career as a direct balance to what Obama was doing. And so I just bring this up because I'm not, once again, pretending to have any answers, but I do think I'm working with some principles. And I think that's what Lisa's presenting to us with that circle of what you can ask. I think you asked, what did you say? Can't we speak? And I think that's a very good research question. And I think that's what we're all demonstrating here. In our struggles to find the appropriate words for an ecology that's an ecology movement that is just beginning, I think, to touch a lot of people's imaginations, because they're seeing things are so dire right now, and many of us are forced to think in ways we've never had to think before. It wasn't convenient to do so, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I think we're starting to see how deeply broken and divided it has become. And so now I believe we do have to generate desired outcomes, and we have to reflect upon how do we implement those desired outcomes? And we have to be very good at being able to take a critical view about that dynamic.
I find it interesting in this country how little we learn from what works in other countries. You know, and maybe it's just we're not ready to yet, but you know,
arrogance.
Yeah. When you were speaking, John, I was thinking about the workers in South America, particularly I know of, you know, Argentina, who decided to, you know, they weren't being paid, but they were still being required to work, and it was a very unfair situation. And they kicked out the owners and took over a lot of the industries, and became, you know, employee-owned industries. So yeah, the ruling elite class, they said, we don't need you, and continued on their own. What was the other example I was gonna give? I can't remember. But another interesting thing that Finland is doing, you know, in this age of misinformation and disinformation. They're teaching elementary school kids how to recognize propaganda. They're teaching critical thinking skills so that you don't just buy whatever somebody tells you. You learn how to think through it and ask, you know, what's true about this? What's not true about this? There was something else that we can learn a lot from what other countries are doing. I know what it was. Sorry, Michael, this will be quick. Currency. The instability of our currency and all the machinations they go through to prop it up. The Swiss, in addition to their state currency, you know, the Swiss franc, they had an alternative currency called the Weir. And when the Swiss franc collapsed, the Weir was there to like cushion the blow so that, you know, you don't go into like this deep economic depression. You've got this other form of currency that's a little more kind of barter and trade to keep the economy going when the state currency is, you know, kaput. Alternative currencies, I think are like, if not illegal, you know, there are tax implications. If we as a country decided, okay, we need a kind of cushion or a both and system for different types of currencies, depending on sort of like, you know, how the economy is going or not going at any given time. When that's playing an infinite game. That's saying, you know, how can we keep going when the going gets rough, as opposed to the finite game, which is how can I amass as much money as possible and take it from other people? Okay, now I'm rambling. Go ahead.
I just want to go back to this issue about power, because as I was listening and stuff, and especially as Johnny and the issue of power and democracy, capitalism and stuff, and the elite and stuff, I started feeling into how I had to relax my power with my children as they grew older, and not be the authoritarian parent. And relax the power, share power, learning how to share power, give them agency and stuff. And I think this is might be, or from my, this comes into play with me a lot, is how am I using power? How are people using power with me? How are we sharing power? I think I know that with certain people, I can't even bring up the word power without them getting nervous around it, because and included in the issue of power, just by the polarity, is a sense of powerlessness. And I'm using that more or less, if I have to share power, I have to give up power, you know? And I think that tension is an example of buying into the polarity of us get versus them, because my understanding of politics in my simple-minded way is how do we share resources and get out of this us versus them so much polarity when it comes to power.
So are you using power in the sense of, you know, like your internal sovereignty, or are you using power in the sense of control and having.
I'm talking about all of the above. I'm saying that all of us, agency is about having a sense of power. I'm talking about deep life, that what is the power of creativity, what the ability to make things happen, like kind of Johnny did. It's the ability. How do we make things happen? And if I can't do it with you, I'm going to just smash the living fuck out of you because you don't agree with me. You know, it's that sense of how do I make something happen? How do I, you know, move? How do I share that with other people? And this is what I struggle with, because I know we have to do it collectively, but individually, we have a lot of individuals that they're at a certain level of understanding of that sense of power that, to put it bluntly and probably not in the best way, they're still teenagers.
Right.
In a way.
I'm sure all of us have had experiences and perhaps narratives or stories that are back there as background knowledge that you've forgotten about. Sometimes they come forward again. As I was reading Infinite Games, the book that was signed, I remember I was once in an organization. I was in the sales. I was recruiting people for this particular organization, and I was making a lot of money because it was commission-based. They filed Chapter 11, and there was a, and we all knew this, but what happened was they failed to give us our paychecks, and the whole company was freaked out. You know, we don't have a paycheck. We knew that we were in Chapter 11, and I quickly made some phone calls, and oh, the president of the company had disappeared. No one knew where he was. And so everyone else was screaming and running around hysterically. I got on the phone and I made a few phone calls, and I called some New York State Department of Justice, whatever. And there was a person who was working with the company I was working with that had filed Chapter 11. And I asked him, I'll never forget his name. His name was Mr. Hatchett. And I asked Mr. Hatchett hypothetical questions about the state of Chapter 11 and what agreements my company had made with the state in order to get Chapter 11 protection. And he listed some things. And one of them was that everyone gets paid on time. If everyone isn't paid on time, then the president of the company is in contempt of court. Not only can he lose everything, he can go to jail. Now, my thought was, well, what's in it for me if this guy goes to jail and the whole company goes under? All my fellow employees lose everything. I don't want that to happen. So the vice president came into our workspace, and he started to give us his song and dance routine about why we couldn't get paid, why our checks weren't going to be available to us in the short term. Long term, we would definitely all get caught, get paid. And I interrupted him. I called him by his first name. I said, "Does Mr. Hatchett know about this?" His face turned white. He said, "Hold that thought." He left the room. And guess what? The president of the company appeared out of nowhere and said, "Would everyone leave except for John?" And everyone left, and it was just me and the president of the company. And I'd only talked to a couple of times. And he said to me, "What do you want?" And I paused, and then that's when I pressed the pause button. Because I said, well, do I want to play a finite game? Because I could get a lot from him. Because I knew he was in contempt of court and could go to jail. But I also knew, wait a minute, I have a long life ahead of me. And I said, I want my paycheck. And he said, "Will you take a personal check?" And I said, "No, I want cash." And he said, "Come by my office in 5 minutes, it'll be ready for you." And that's what I did. And I quit. Simply because I was there to recruit people for this organization. How could I ethically recruit people to join this organization when I knew how corrupt it was? And I understand it was reported back to me from a fellow employee when the president heard that I had quit. He was absolutely shocked. But I think these are the opportunities. I'm remembering that now because I realize how often we are invited and seduced and controlled by those who want us to play a finite game. And sometimes at great risk to ourselves, we'll reject that and play an infinite game, even though we won't get rewarded for it. Certainly on the scale that those who are willing to play a finite game are. So anyway, I'm just bringing that up to hopefully invoke in your own complex histories opportunities you've had to move from a finite to an infinite game, or from an infinite game to a finite game, or whatever, and how that can get, how that can, I believe, change the toxic environment that you're in. In my instance, in my case, I didn't have any children to support. I didn't have to put any kids through college. So I could leave that toxic environment. But I realized a lot of people would say, well, I have obligations. I got bills to pay. I got to take this, you know, shitty circumstances. Okay, that's a choice that you made. And at the end of your life, and you look back on it, realize what you've done. And that's where I believe that that future orientation, which I think visionaries tend to be tapping into in our culture. It's not about the win-lose of the day, but it's about, well, what are you going to leave after you're dead and gone? What are the living arrangements that you've created the conditions for? And that's where I think the visionary is extremely important. And that's why I don't think our politicians are good at that, because they have term limits and they don't give a shit about the future. But I think if enough human, that's why vision, the people perish without a vision. We the people have to have a vision, not the politician, the Democrat or the Republican that's being put forward by the corporate sponsor, but we the people.
So we're coming up on 11:30, and I want to just tell you a little bit about the final workshop next week. So what I'm going to do is introduce you to what my next project is. So what I'm working on now, and we might do a perspective taking kind of exercise, because it's really grounded in being able to take perspectives other than your own and hold multiple perspectives simultaneously. So I'll also tell you about an idea that I'm kicking around, you know, like long-term future, in case anybody wants to get involved. I don't know when it'll happen, but you know, at least I finally got clear on the idea. I mean, I've had this idea for about 3 or 4 years now, but it was too fuzzy and too incoherent, and finally I gained some coherency to it. So I'll share that with you too. So the questions that, you know, if we didn't find things to talk about, which we sure did, and it was a great discussion, but I'll just leave you with the questions that I was going to share with you. If you want to think about them. So if this course has changed your worldview in any way, what has changed? If you had to write a term paper for this course, what might your topic be? And how can language help to, quote, keep the game going? Those are the questions that I had.
Lisa, could I ask you to post those in the thread for this, both the slide with the all the topics around the circle and the questions themselves?
Oh, sure. Yeah, good idea.
I don't have time to do that to go into it in any depth right now, but
right, yeah,
we could in the thread. Mm-hmm.
Lisa, I just wanted to ask, you had assigned a poem by Steve Rosen.
Yeah, he just sent that to me like a couple weeks ago. And so I asked him, I said, can I share it with my group?
Okay, well, we didn't get to read it or talk about it or anything. I just want to say I really liked it and appreciated it. And I thought it was beautiful. So perhaps some future session we'll get to. It'd be nice to read, I think. Read aloud.
Read aloud, yeah. Yeah, it would be. That's a good idea.
That's all.
All right. Any parting thoughts from anybody?
I do want to say that I think, like, democracy, I mean, we can't take it for granted. It's a practice. And, like, not anybody can be a democratic participant. Like, to play that game takes a certain skill set, and it takes information that's accurate, and it takes perspective taking. Like, there's a lot that goes into it, and probably at the core of it is education. So
and heart. It takes heart.
You gotta care. You gotta care.
Parker Palmer wrote a book called The Heart of Democracy. That's a very well written book of the roots of democracy and how to maintain heart while trying to, like you say, Marco, practicing democracy.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, I think that's where, like, maybe fractal democracy is something we have to think about. You know, like, it's hard to be a democratic citizen in a global, let alone a national society. Like, it's just, but if you can do it at scale, that is like a human scale, and then the aggregate effect of that, I think, could be global, or maybe there's other mechanisms at, you know, larger scales. But I think to not have that kind of experience of power in community, you know, like, I think it seems to be really like, what's the word, just detrimental, I guess, to even our health, you know.
I think
I would agree.
Talking about the fractal, a new kind of geometry, which is actually brought about by the use of a computer. And our founding fathers were definitely Euclidean geometers. All men are created equal is an axiomatic, you know, comes out of a very Euclidean world. But I think we're moving out of we're not dealing with just with fractal geometry. And paraconsistent logics. We're also dealing with and the non-Aristotelian logics of Grand Priest and the non-Newtonian. We're moving into the Einsteinian physics. So we're dealing with these new capacities that are coming at us and how, what new kind of psychic landscapes are being created by us as individuals and groups and larger groups, and how can we reframe and deframe and unframe what we've been given, and how are we, how are we going to harness our intentions and our attention together, share attention, so that we can perhaps create new technologies. But I'm reminded of, I was listening to Nikki Giovanni, the poet, in dialogue with James Baldwin, a novelist. This was like 30, 40 years ago. And I thought it was very interesting because he was old enough to be her father. But he often talked to her in the language of a lover, of a male lover to a female lover, even though she was his daughter's age, and even though he was a gay man, you know. But he obviously was able to embody this and speak from that persona. And she was able to differentiate. Oh yeah, he's playing an infinite game, and I can play an infinite game with him as well. But you said something very beautiful, I thought. He said, Black people, white people are inside Black people, and Black people are inside white people. Very paradoxical statement. And she said, yeah, and you know, sometimes there may be a person who has a black body, but a white mind. And very rarely, she says, you'll find a person with a white body and a black mind. And I went, whoa, this is frying my brains, because I had a boyfriend who happened to be black, who one day he told me, I remember he put his hand on, his finger on my chest. I think we just had a fight. And he put a finger on my chest and he said, deep down inside of you, there's a black woman. And I went, okay, it was a very disorienting moment, but I sort of knew what he meant. Because I listened to so much Billie Holiday, you know, and also these intergenerational attractions, which history is full of, and bring with them an overlapping culture as well. So, and I think we're in the middle of this with Black Lives Matter, changing our political dynamic very, very quickly, and in a kind of explosive summer, and with George Floyd's murder, and how some of us have somatized these dynamics and dealing with the white body supremacy. Those of us who can't step into that fray, and not everybody is going to want to even do that, but those of us who can and who have the skillfulness to do that, I believe we can create new opportunities for, you know, that somatic intelligence in this, you know, the battlefield of technology that's happening, how we can catch a rhythm from one another that's a ecological and healthy and sounder than the kind of algorithmic drive that many of us are dancing to, a tune that isn't human anymore. Anyway, that's my spiel. I hope that made sense to somebody. Thank you.
I just want to say, Lisa, that I'm glad that you brought forth this cafe. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, thank Marco. He's the one who put the idea in.
Thank John. He actually suggested it. I did the tech support, basically.
Well, let's thank all three of you.
I thank all of you for co-sponsoring this learning curve. We've all created the conditions for this. So blessings to everyone. Thank you. And it will keep on going. When this course is over, I'm sure that the learnings will still accumulate and come at us. Thanks.
I've also enjoyed, so Lisa, we met in Boulder. Was it 2 years ago now? Last year, I can't remember now. But it's been great to get to know you a little bit through this other means as well, and keep the connection going. So thank you for this.
Likewise. All right. So I look forward to seeing you all next week. There's Misha back. Yeah, so I've got some fun stuff to share with you that I've only told John Dotson. you'll be the next. It's I'll give part of it away.
I didn't realize I was muted. I'm sorry. I was telling that I'm working on my comments, end of semester comments for the students, and I have to write quite extensively, and it's a lot of work for me. So I was off and on. Well,
thanks for taking time out of your day to be with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a great journey. Yeah, I learned a lot and still thinking about many things that we touched on.
Come back, Misha. Come back to the cafes.
Yeah, I will.
After this course is over, you know, the cafes, there are all kinds of other topics.
Cultural semantics. We're going to get into it.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Cool. So, I finally invented a new preposition.
Oh, no.
I'll share that with you next week.
Oh.
Oh, I'm okay. Looking forward to that.
Looking forward to it.
I thought, Michael, you used that term grok at the first, in your first comment on the thing. That was a lovely, because that was an introduced word by Heinlein, right? So
Yeah.
Great word.
Thank you for the article about how do we get to herd immunity for fake news.
Yeah.
It's really interesting what it says about how education can help people think better than they are today.
Yeah, and in the thread, I'll put the article, there's an article from The Guardian from a while back about how Finland started educating people to be able to deal with all of this fake news.
Cool, so great.
I'll post that too.
Lisa, you're going to post all that on the thread?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Alrighty, well, go in peace.
Happy stay holidays. Healthy, everyone. Stay
happy
strong.
Happy holidays. Be safe. Long
and prosperous.
Yes, happy holidays.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.